Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
Good evening, and welcome to History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please do so at toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Please call me and tell me your views. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You can also find me on the web at www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. That's www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Please visit my website and leave me a blog in the fast chat or message me sections of the webpage. Tell me what's on your mind. I would also ask you to help me sustain the show by keeping it going on a weekly basis through your generous donation. There is a donate button on the webpage for you to easily contribute. Please be generous. Your contribution to the show is a very special help to me. Thank you. And I do look forward to reading your blog. Tonight's show is brought to you by the folks at FX Software and Sweet Pea Women's Apparel by Stacy Frati. Tonight's topic, betrayal or patriotism? Public opinion is a fickle thing. In war, public opinion is one of those things that you don't want to ignore because of the enormous consequences it can have for governments and its leaders. Many historians in the past have pointed out that going to war without public opinion on your side is like shooting yourself in the foot and then expecting to keep running for several more miles. It's a futile attempt. President Wilson knew that only too well when leading an isolationist nation after the war had broken out in Europe in 1914, but before his re-election in 1916. Hence the reason why he wins the election again. Remember the slogan that brought him an electoral victory? Quote, "He kept us out of the war," unquote. FDR was another president who knew that lesson very well, as he gradually made careful calculations to slowly change America's foreign policy into a more pro-war mindset in closely measured increments. For example, his Lend-Lease Act with England, as well as his arms shipments to Chiang Kai-shek in China to fight off the Japanese when they took the province of Manchuria in 1937, were not consistent with the expectations that came from the Neutrality Acts. But the case of FDR and his relations with public opinion is even more interesting because he knew he needed war badly in order to bring to American businesses the degree of economic production that only war can bring as a measure of getting the American economy up and out of the final straps of the Depression. But regardless of what he thought personally, FDR never dared to push the limits of civil society to the point of risking war without first considering what people might have to say about that move. FDR wanted to go to war, but he respected public opinion more. Even in September of 1941, when national polls were showing that approximately 80% of the nation still favored neutrality, FDR, after all of his efforts at lend-leasing, still didn't make a move. It wasn't until the Japanese Empire made their move in drawing first blood on December 7th of that year that the pendulum of public opinion swung radically to the other side, giving FDR what he was waiting for. War. War to help the economy against the last remnants of the Depression. and public opinion on his side. It can also be argued that President George Bush Sr. knew the same lesson well enough when he successfully solicited and received national and global consensus for war and economic sanctions against Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War. However, American history has also shown us several presidents who knew the lesson of public opinion, but chose to ignore it for other explanations and excuses. Such presidents have been Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon over the war in Vietnam. Vietnam, a painful memory still in the minds and hearts of many Americans, remains a sober reminder that when public opinion is not on your side, united and looking in the same direction, the results can be found in city riots, racism, angry music, civil protests, dark poetry, and drugging for idleness. It was a national cry that culminated in what came to be called Woodstock. Is war good for business and the economy? Well, some historians would argue affirmatively, and they would base their arguments on the results that came from the Roaring Twenties and the post-war boom that came to America in the 1950s and 1960s. And there are also those people who would never claim such a thing, because the anguish of war foretells of a time when the purpose of the fight was lost and replaced with the sadness found in the loss of life and family, where the economic gains were convoluted, and where the media fabricated a new image of public opinion based on an ambivalent public that wreaked equal parts of apathy and insecurity. Was the journey of Vietnam one of betrayal, or was it one of patriotism? Here tonight to talk about the issue of betrayal or patriotism in connection with Vietnam is an educator, a writer, a consultant, a man who holds a doctorate degree from Rutgers University, which he earned under the GI Bill. He is now professor emeritus at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and he continues to publish widely in professional journals, periodicals, and leading newspapers like the New York Times. This gentleman is also president of DW Global Strategies Incorporated, an educational and management consulting firm dedicated to serving its clients by providing personal and sensitive programs and services. A captain in the United States Army, platoon leader, executive officer, acting company commander with the 228th Signal Company in Vietnam from 1966 to 1967, and a member of the New Jersey Vietnam Memorial Commission, dedicated by General Norman Schwarzkopf in 1994. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I present to you Dr. David Weishattle. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, George. Appreciate that kind introduction.
David, there is a history in everything, as we know, and we're all here to take a part of that history on a daily basis. So why don't you tell us, America has a history of wars that stand long and extended. Where do they begin?
Well, I guess the real big question is, where do they end, too? We don't seem to be able to stay out of war. In spite of, I think, your comments of how we got into the various wars, it's kind of interesting, just to carry that a little bit further. We got into Vietnam by virtue of, or we got into it big time anyway, by virtue of this the Bay of Tonkin incident, where it seems to be, doesn't really seem to be a real incident at all.
that Gulf of Tonkin resolution was well, what so many books have described it as, a blank check, just to do war to whatever extent possible.
Right. Yeah. We have never been able to come up with the exact details, even though each side or several sides have tried to detail exactly what happened, when it happened, and why it occurred, and so on. But it was the kind of thing that pushed us over the cliff and jumped in big time.
Right, right. Right.
And for
that's
many of
true.
Us at that time, you know, you're talking about Kennedy, the Johnson, and Nixon through that period. My time, I was commissioned as an officer in 1963 with Kennedy still in the White House. And by the time that I got on active duty, Lyndon Johnson was then taking the lead, and we're not sure whether he carried out Kennedy's policy or he started new policies or what was going on. But we were in full-fledged war by the time he was ready to leave the office.
Right.
Because
well,
he didn't
really remember,
know what to do.
Remember also, David, that the at that time period, fighting communism or giving the public image that one was had to be strong on communism if one were to expect to hold public office was really important. I would say it was even more important back then than what a public official today is publicly committed to the idea of fighting terrorism. Fighting communism was very, very, very important. Well, I mean, the whole McCarthy era speaks for itself as far as the national paranoia that grew from there. So I think that Johnson had an obsession with needing to come across publicly, domestically and internationally, as a man who was going to be strong and tough on communism no matter what it took. And that seems to make a real interesting and close connection with the whole Gulf of Tonkin resolution, because, like you stated correctly, it was never resolved.
No. And we never knew. There were many things such as that. And it was a constant war of that sort. Who began what battle? Who stopped it? Who started it? How many, you know, we got into this issue about how we, the way we estimated our victories was through a body count, which proved to be inflated by both sides and deflated by both sides whenever it wished to make a point.
Right.
I mean, it was a war of literally smoke and mirrors in many ways.
Right. David, how important in your estimation is public opinion in relation to foreign policy and war?
Well, you know, let me speak from the standpoint of having been in the military in the mid-60s. At that time, public opinion was, if not neutral, a little bit in favor of doing something. But it got tired. It got tired of it very quickly. And the military.
Yeah, it got very old then.
Yeah, military as well. When I left Vietnam in 1967, the military was in very good shape. It wasn't maybe 2 years still when we started to see it fall apart a little bit. We saw things like fragging going on, where an officer would issue an order, and if the troops didn't like it, they'd roll a grenade under the tent. And those are extremes, but in many cases, how the policy was being implemented in the field was creating problems. In some cases, they were very active, and other cases, troops would sit around for long periods of time.
David, how would you describe the relationship between the American public and Vietnam policies?
Well, I think it was for a while of a sense of, well, let the leaders take care of it, and, you know, we trust them, and we believe them that they're going to do what's right. And I think in many cases the leadership thought they were doing what was right. And it's a question of how do you make good estimates? And it's difficult. It's easy to look back. If you look at what's happening now in Ukraine, where, you watch the pundits on television, and there's a group that know exactly what should be done, how it should be done, and where it should be. Others are, well, here are 1,000 alternatives. You pick the one you want. down at the other extreme, and there's a lack of clarity in the immediate situation. No one knows what to do. Is the president strong enough? Is he too strong? Does he
right.
give in too easy? Does he
right.
Does he...
Well, you know, maybe you've encountered the same thing, David, but I'm about to go on a rant because it seems to me that the older I become, and you might share the same sentiments, I don't know, the wiser one can easily become as well. One is commensurate to the other. For example, if you define wisdom as insight based on experience, my experience has shown me that what has happened in the past with American involvement in foreign wars, what has happened in Europe throughout the middle of the 20th century with World War II, the Prague Spring against the Soviets in 1968, the Hungarian Revolution that was also put down by the Soviets in 1956, you come to see the nature of the missile crisis, where a lot of people really don't know exactly how close the entire world came to mutual destruction. And now you come across the Ukraine thing. Human nature, I'm going to claim cynically, is pathetically predictable. Because what's happened in the Ukraine is not a whole lot different from the usual pattern of dealing with the Soviets in the Cold War as well. My studies have shown me, and please, sir, correct me if you feel that I am way off base, the best position to deal with the Soviets is from a position of strength. You cannot expect to employ and use effectively soft power unless you have hard power as your insurance policy to be able to operationalize that at a given moment's notice in order to enforce the soft power policies that you want to negotiate with the Soviets or another rogue power. Would I be completely off base in this estimation?
No, I don't think so. I think the issue here is how do you define the power and how does it get perceived? Not to go back to Vietnam, but Vietnam is a classic example. There was no more powerful army than the one we had on the field in Vietnam. And
right.
we won battles. We very seldom it came out on the short end of it. But in the end, we lost that. We lost the country in a sense of we didn't reach our goals and we didn't attain what we wanted to do. But that doesn't mean that power isn't very effective. It means perhaps we just didn't use it as effectively as we could have, and we didn't marshal the support of the public. I think the unknown at this stage is the importance of the people in the Ukraine and the Crimea.
Right.
I think if they are really dedicated and they really are strong and they want to do something, that's a factor that all the powers have got to recognize. And the other unknown at this stage of the game as well, which we didn't have way back when, is the social media. We know what's going on all the time. We
right.
see it. We have it all. And you can't move. I mean, when the Soviets moved their troops in, we all knew it because people were reporting it.
Right.
They were telling
right.
everyone about it.
So right.
I think there's a certain element of truth about strength. There's the idea of trying to negotiate from weakness, I think, is not viable.
Right.
You have to have strength, and the question is
right.
what kind of strength. I mean, so the word is now that we're going to reduce the size of the military because the military should be able to do different things because they've got different equipment, better thinking, better minds, better equipped, better, more powerful, smaller, more mobile, faster to get places. And we don't need as many men, as many tanks, as many planes, as many whatever.
Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I don't think I have enough wisdom to try to deal with that. The real problem with that is... Now here we were fighting a two war. We've been in two wars for the last 10 years, I guess. You get pretty strung out, and you're depending a great deal. And one of the reasons why public is pretty supportive of what's going on to this date is that it's been done with a volunteer army. you know, no one's being drafted. No one's
right.
being conscripted out of jobs, out of their lives, removed
right.
and sent
right.
somewhere they don't want to go,
right.
which was not true to the 60s and 70s when we had to draft.
Right.
And of course, on Korea
right.
as well. So
David,
David,
let me ask you, going back to Vietnam for just a moment,
sure.
do you see it as a betrayal or a patriotic experience?
Well, there's a little bit of both involved in all that. I mean, most Americans feel a commitment to service, whether it's military service or it's Peace Corps or police and fire and health and nursing and so on, teaching. So we do have a service element in our makeup and our character. So I think we all have that kind of... I think we get a little turned off when we sometimes find out that it's not, we went to Iraq and there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Right,
we went,
right.
You know,
but with the Vietnam experience, do you see it more of a betrayal or more patriotic?
Well,
if you had to choose, which one would you probably rally around more often than not?
Well, I think there was a failure of policy and a betrayal of policy, really. We did not know what we wanted to do there. And we told, we told the world that we're going to save them for, democracy and so on. We started to realize that everybody doesn't want our version of democracy, if they want democracy at all.
Right, right.
And I would say if we knew what was happening in Vietnam today, what happened regardless of whether it was a war or not, I think we would say, no, we're not going to go to war because, Ford Motor Company, major corporations are all throughout Vietnam. You go into a local, your clothing store, and you buy a shirt made in Vietnam. We've had repair work done by Vietnamese who don't even remember the war.
Right. David, between Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, which of these men, in your opinion, do you think best served the purpose of Vietnam?
Well, I think if you read the history books and if they seem to be right, Nixon has always been very sinister. Johnson does not come off too well. Kennedy, the most defenders of Kennedy would say he never intended to go into a full-force war. There would always been advisors, and that would be where he'd stop and so on. And I don't know if there's enough to know whether what he would do. But Johnson certainly got in, and I think the classic guy that every Vietnam veteran or otherwise thinks about is McNamara, who seems to be... seems to epitomize the confusion up at the top levels about what was going to go on there.
Yeah.
And I think most people who look at Vietnam, look at those ending days as not being the most honorable days at all.
Would you parallel a person like General Westmoreland to McNamara in terms of further convoluting policies in Vietnam?
Well, Westmoreland was the... he tried to fight. Well, the real difficulty, it seems to me, was that they were trying to fight a military war in Vietnam in a political situation. And the more military you got, the less it worked. I mean, you could field the strongest troops and the best soldiers, and it didn't seem to work because it wasn't working. I mean, even the greatest success that the Viet Cong had in Tet, really, after you sum it all up and you look at all, Tet was a loss for the Viet Cong and for the North Vietnamese.
Yeah, it's almost as if public opinion among the Vietnamese
it didn't matter.
Won
public
over.
Opinion said, public opinion was not didn't care about that. Public opinion said, get the hell out.
Yeah.
Let's
get
out of here.
Yeah.
Let's save, instead of having 106,000 people on the wall, let's stop with 56,000.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the truth. When you look at the blood and toil, maybe the war was not the best thing to do.
David, let's talk about your book entitled 228.
Well, that's not bad. I think we've been talking. I think that's the kind of confusion we ran into as soldiers over there. We didn't know what to do. And what we wound up doing was we did what we did every day, and dealt with that kind of stuff. We ran into problems. The first thing I got over there and was that we had a murder in the unit, which becomes kind of the basis for what the book was about.
Yeah.
And it was one of our guys against another guy, and they just got on each other's nerves, and one took it upon himself to do evil to the other guy. And it began that way, it was always that way. You thought you knew what your job was, you did your job, and sometimes it worked that way, sometimes it didn't. The Signal Corps, I was an officer in the Signal Corps, when we had units with three or four major infantry company units, divisions. We had units with Special Forces. We had units with the Air Force. So we were kind of fragmented over all these different areas, and plus we were running such commonplace things as the telephone system in a major city at the Trang.
David, let me ask you a comparative question by nature.
Sure.
What you describe in the book as an environment that is supposed to be an environment where you were expected to do your job the best you knew how and carry out your orders and so forth, and yet so many things began to unravel, things that you never really expected and came as a shock or surprise to you. How would that compare to living in an inner city environment where the violence is rampant, completely unpredictable, and you really don't know what to expect as you live day in, day out in that kind of volatile environment?
Well, it's one of those kinds of places where you could go day in and day out, and things get very commonplace, and you don't expect to, and then one day something goes wrong. Something blows up, someone gets attacked. A unit gets mauled, or something gets some ambush occurs. We used to drive back and forth on what was U.S. Highway 1, not up and down the east coast of the United States, but up and down the east coast of South Vietnam. And Route 1 was a nightmare. In some cases, you could travel along the road and not have any problems. The next day, you could be ambushed. Troops were always ready for that, but in the same token, you'd have 2, 3, 4, 5 days of very pleasant driving and experience, and all of a sudden, one day, everything is all different. So
wow.
it was an environment that was never settled, never. And then there were just some kinds of things. You'd get people who would be hurt by doing something. A generator would blow up, something of that sort would happen, not by virtue of an enemy, but just by virtue of the equipment itself.
Wow.
We were a very low-tech military in Vietnam. Today, probably every GI has a cell phone, a tablet, maybe a computer. They're carrying around thousands of dollars worth of helmets and high-powered automatic weapons and so on. We were over there with we had about 120 men. We had about 120 M14s, which were an excellent rifle, but did not have the firepower of an M16 or anything else of the sort. So,
wow.
And we were more technical than tactical in many ways, because we were trained to, I was never trained to be a Signal Corps officer. I was a social studies teacher, and so your history lesson fell in very nicely. And so I got over there, and everybody thought I was an engineer. But I told everybody pretty quick. I know how to turn the radio on. And that's it.
All right. Well, let me continue talking about your book.
Sure.
Because I think the experiences are really quite wrenching. But first, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back to discuss Betrayal or Patriotism on History and You in just a moment.
Just to break it down. We build it up just to break it down.
In a world dominated by frameworks, platforms, and tools, it's difficult to know how to win. when the only certainty is change. At Software FX, customer service and highly useful products are our main goals. Over 20 years of experience, coupled with ideas and inspiration from more than 150,000 developers all over the world, have turned into business intelligence tools that provide more choice, convenience, and value to our customers and partners. Yes, technologies do change, but Software FX has your back. That's Software FX, data visualization for every need, every platform. Call us today, toll free, at 1-800-392-4278. That's 1-800-392-4278. Be the master of your data. Software FX. Sweet Pea by Stacy Frotte is a woman's contemporary clothing line and nationally recognized brand. Sweet Pea is an innovative collection that pairs flirtiness with sensibility. Our Sweet Pea woman can be running a board meeting, watching a soccer game, or dining out with friends. Sweet Pea is recognized to be eye-catching and edgy. We empower our loyal worldwide customer base by creating clothing that fits their lifestyle. She is on the move and believes that Sweet Pea is her go-to on almost all occasions. Day into night, Sweet Pea's stylish blouses move with you and your busy day. Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Anthropologie, and the Sweet Pea by Stacy Frotte website feature new Sweet Pea designs weekly. We have been creating beautiful clothing for 16 years, and there is no sign of us slowing down. Fashion is cyclical, it is true, but style is a constant. Please visit www.sweetpeabystacyfrotte.com today.
Okay, and we are back to discuss the topic for this evening's show, Betrayal or Patriotism, on History and You. David, quick question. How would you want the leitmotif of your book, the recurring theme, to be remembered by your audience?
Well, I as I put the book together, what I tried to do is when you're writing a novel, one of the things you got to do is remember what you're trying to do and who's doing what, when, and how. So what I tried to do is I tried to use the time I was there as kind of the structure, the foundation, and I moved it through the kinds of experience I was going through and so on. And I think it's kind of like, how does the ordinary person deal with all these different things that are going on at this time, including some other things that one didn't anticipate. One thought you'd go to war. It starts right off, you start, you'd be armed and ready to do what you were supposed to do. Instead, you're over there standing there in a khaki uniform, waiting for somebody to pick you up at an airport.
Yeah.
It's like being at Kennedy Airport, trying to find somebody to pick you up and whatever. So you got all those normal kinds of things going on, and then there's some unusual kinds of things as well. And then there's a war in the background. And these kinds of things going on. So, it was an experience for me as a young man to go through this, and experience, and still realize that life just keeps going on. That these kinds of events are kind of regular events, and they have
and
to
if
deal
you
with
can
them,
pinpoint what inspired you to write the book, what would you? What would you point toward?
Well, I would just look at this. Here's this horrendous experience that, and everybody has kind of a different experience with a war. And in some cases, it's where you're in this heavy combat situation. It's a real personal kind of relationship. You see these experiences and you take these experiences away with you and you can't leave them. Probably for 80% of the veterans who've come back, they haven't had that deep experience. And they can come back and do things on a regular basis and get things done. But what I just tried to do is, in some cases, it's the normalcy of war. In other cases, it's the unusualness of war. I think it's just an attempt to kind of give perhaps a non-military person a chance to see what this stuff is very much like. Because one of the things that an army does when it gets into an area, it starts to urbanize. So we urbanized the areas around where all our bases were.
Right.
We were a major economic force for many of the local people.
Right.
The opening of the air base was like a factory here in the United States. The whistle would blow and everybody would walk through the gate, just like we've done here. So there was a kind of a normalcy and an abnormalcy at the same time. You're right. It was very much. I came back in from the war, and we were having riots. My first job in New Jersey was an administrator in a school district that was having major street problems. And NORC was not doing well in New Jersey as well. So it was a time of turmoil.
Yeah.
And it's what war does. I think you're right about public opinion. Public opinion just went bad.
Yeah.
And it went bad fast.
Let me ask you, draw on the personal experiences that people have from war, take away from war. And I'm shifting gears here just a bit, but it certainly can very easily tap into your eminently qualified position to comment on this. How in the world, based on your experience and the way you've discussed war now as a very unpredictable package, how could My Lai occur? How could something like that at My Lai with Lieutenant Calley ever take place?
Well, you could probably look at a lot of things. One of the things, as my book kind of lays out, you have many different qualities of people in different positions of power and authority, and at many times they are totally on their own. For a while, in isolation, you could very well find yourself. We happen to be on an island, so for a while, and the island, while for many months, whoever was in charge of everybody there, and what was that person's desire came about. And I think that's one of the things that we saw here, that we probably empowered an individual that probably should not have been empowered. Lieutenant Calley may not have been the right person to be an officer. The officer and even the non-commissioned officers should have that ability to say, no, that's not the right thing to do, we're not going to do it. Instead, there was that kind of time in many units where it seemed like, well, this is what we should do. We should retaliate. We should do this because they did this to us and so on. And that was just, I think that's one of the things. Prior to my going to Vietnam, I was in Fort Gordon, Georgia, in the officer's candidate. I was teaching in the officer's candidate school. And there was such a strong need for junior officers that they were looking at making people officers that maybe in other times they may not have been the ones chosen to be officers.
Right.
But there were,
David, how would you describe the morale among Vietnam veterans today in relation to the war? We know that when they came over, they were mistreated, abused, verbally abused, all sorts of things we know. But today, how would you describe the morale among Vietnam vets in relation to the war?
Well, I if you look at the vast majority, most Vietnam veterans have gotten back into the system and have done, if not well, at least as well as others. Use this kind of an 80% do okay, 20% probably you're not. The old 80-20 concept. There's still a lot of Vietnam veterans lingering in prisons. There's still a very large Vietnam population that's homeless. There's a very large, you know, drug, alcohol abuse situation. But we're aging. And we're, you know, we talk, there are very few World War II veterans left. there are a number of Korean, but when you start looking at where what the numbers are today, the Vietnam veterans are starting to die off and decline in size, and many of those who had those kinds of problems probably are passing. But we will probably very shortly find that the problem and non-problem Vietnam vets are going to all wind up in the same place in nursing homes, as will most of all of us, in some kind of long-term
care.
But
you do see a reconciliation having taken place, haven't you?
Well,
in terms of their morale?
Yeah, I would guess most Vietnam veterans feel good about how people feel about the most recent veterans.
Yeah.
Which were not. I mean, if you compare the Vietnam veteran of the 4th of July, the novel and the movie, and then you compare it today, the treatment is much better.
Yeah.
VA
David,
hospitals
are
much better.
Do you think public opinion has learned a lesson from the experiences veterans brought back from Vietnam? In other words, I'm reversing the question here because everyone knows how important or significant one should consider public opinion, but do you think public opinion now as the dependent variable here, do you think public opinion has learned a lesson from the experiences that veterans have brought back?
Well, I guess cynically I would probably say no, because I think what's happened with Vietnam veterans is that people just really don't think about it. And I don't think they mean that in a cruel or mean sense, but it's just that it's out of their view. It's out of their and there's the focus now on Iraq, and I'm pretty soon sure Iraqi veterans will be the Afghanistan. You know, it's a focus on now, and maybe that's a problem our society. We focus so much on now. It wasn't until World War II veterans got 60, 70, 80 years away from the war. Now we're getting almost 50 years away from what may have been the beginning of Vietnam, and so it becomes more historical than it does social. And and I think I don't know what to make of. I mean, veterans are much better in a much better situation they are today than they were whenever. That we think about them.
Yeah,
in the
especially
last 20,
when they came
years.
Back from Vietnam. Yeah.
Another
question I wanted to.
We did ourselves some damage, too. I mean, Calais, the My Lai, and some of the stuff.
Right.
But, some of it was an extension of the dislike of the war. You know, they tried to, hate the war, love the warrior.
Right.
I don't know if that's ever played out. I think I'm not so sure. I think it's still out, the jury on all that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you also was if Vietnam was good for American businesses and industry. But we'll take a look at that in just a moment. But first, let's take another quick break, and we'll be right back to discuss betrayal or patriotism on History and You in just a moment.
In a world dominated by frameworks, platforms, and tools, it's difficult to know how to win when the only certainty is change. At Software FX, customer service and highly useful products are our main goals. Over 20 years of experience, coupled with ideas and inspiration from more than 150,000 developers all over the world, have turned into business intelligence tools that provide more choice, convenience, and value to our customers and partners. Yes, technologies do change, but Software FX has your back. That's Software FX, data visualization for every need, every platform. Call us today, toll free, at 1-800-392-4278. That's 1-800-392-4278. Be the master of your data. Software FX.
Thank you.
Pea by Stacy Frotti is a woman's contemporary clothing line and nationally recognized brand. Sweet Pea is an innovative collection that pairs flirtiness with sensibility. Our Sweet Pea woman can be running a board meeting, watching a soccer game, or dining out with friends. Sweet Pea is recognized to be eye-catching and edgy. We empower our loyal worldwide customer base by creating clothing that fits their lifestyle. She is on the move and believes that Sweet Pea is her go-to on almost all occasions. Day into night, Sweet Pea's stylish blouses move with you and your busy day. Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Anthropologie, and the Sweet Pea by Stacy Frotti website feature new Sweet Pea designs weekly. We have been creating beautiful clothing for 16 years, and there is no sign of us slowing down. Fashion is cyclical, it is true, but style is a constant. Please visit www.sweetpeabystacyfrotti.com today.
Okay, and we are back discussing the topic for this evening's show, Betrayal or Patriotism, on History and You. David, I have just a few more questions that I really want to get in because I find the nature of the book and the conversation really interesting and simply not having enough time to cover it. What makes your book, 228, so different from many others on Vietnam? What can we learn from your book?
War is frequently, you know, we see Full Metal Jacket, Hamburger Hill, and we say, oh, it's terrible, and so on. But war is also an opportunity for young men in my time, and now young men and women, to grow and develop and find themselves that they're able to deal with experiences, and they have opportunity to take on responsibilities that they would not normally have. Sometimes very simple stuff, sometimes very complicated and very detailed stuff. And as the military has grown since my time there to now, it's even got more technical and more electronic-based and so on. But I think it was a great, you know, the military, for many of us, was a great time to explore, to develop, and find crises. So when I put 228 together, I thought the men at that time, the men in the company, were doing great things, and I while I was glad to leave and go home, there was also a feeling of gee, I hate to leave this group of people that I've worked with so long in this dangerous situation.
Yeah,
and I was amazed at my own feelings when I left that was the case. I thought I'd be so glad to get out of there. I wouldn't even take time to say goodbye, but it was very difficult because it was such a camaraderie that developed. And in many cases, for me, an admiration of some of these young men who went out of their way to do outstanding jobs.
Do you see yourself discouraging people from joining the armed forces simply because of the nature of war and how very dangerous it is?
Well, you know, a lot of people look at, well, I get a free education, I do this, I do that. I think you've got to think that out very carefully. Our two sons, I think you've talked to Doug, they're very competent, very able. They're attorneys. They do all. I've never discouraged them, but at the same time, I can't admit that I've encouraged them to think about the military. Because it's one of those places that maybe you really need to have something inside you or something experienced to say, this is where I want to go. Also, in some cases, we've still got this feeling like it's kind of a place of last resort. I can't find a job. I'll join the military. Many of our soldiers at the time were there because they were avoiding something else.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a great place to find yourself. But I think there are other places you could do it too.
Yeah.
Not the only place. So I kind of stay neutral.
Right.
Even though, you know, my experience was that I did well in the military. I was able to use the GI Bill. I got into a field that I wanted to get into. I have great respect for military. I will careful about generals because they tend not to, you know, if you go back to the Civil War, Grant and Lee got more men killed than anybody else in the world, I guess. So they're not the best people to make judgments about that, and I'm surprised sometimes when people say, well, we owe this to the general.
Yeah, I can only expect what your opinion might be of George Patton.
Well, yeah. I mean, he did. To his credit, he said, you know, that one classic, you know, if your job is not to get killed, it's to kill the other guy, you know, and have him worry about being, you know, to die for his country. You should not die for your country. Let the other guy die for his country. Well, but it is still, someone's dying, you know, so we're losing something there in the longer scope of
David, let me ask you very quickly. Vietnam lasted for the better part of almost 15 years, if you start counting from the years of Eisenhower all the way up to the evacuation of Saigon and the American embassy in 1975. Could there be another Vietnam in our future?
Oh, I think so. I think it's. I don't think the folly that men get into and women now get into is just a product of that time. I think we can all do it. I think we're pretty close to it. These two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we're now running 10 years in Afghanistan. And someone said 10 years ago, you know, this is the beginning of a 10-year, you know, we wouldn't be there. We would have thought about doing something else. I think that's one of the problems that one doesn't anticipate long wars. We're a country of short wars and...
Okay, well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. David, thank you so very, very much for sharing your time, your thoughts, your advice, and expertise on the problem of public opinion in the Vietnam War with all of us this evening. It was a learning moment for everyone listening. And don't forget for our audience to pick up his book entitled 228. David, where can we pick this up? Is it on Amazon?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com. You can go to their website, and they'll gladly provide the copies for you. And,
terrific.
And if all fails, go to Barnes & Nobles, and they'll special order it for you.
Terrific.
So, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for the evening.
You're very welcome, sir. Very interesting read for everyone out there. Thank you.
Very good.
And now we've come to that final part of our show where I wish to leave you with a final thought to consider and to further reflect regarding the signs of our times. Some final thoughts. Vietnam was a trauma for the United States, because it could never come to understand how Americans would win all the major battles in the field, but gradually be losing the war. How could such a thing happen? And how did it happen? Americans have fought difficult enemies in jungles before, the Japanese in particular, in places like Burma, now known as Myanmar, the Philippines, and also among a collection of Pacific islands as well. Ah, but Ho Chi Minh didn't underestimate the significance of public opinion. That national force, which gives a moral force to the purpose of the fight, that part of it, Ho understood very well. As did Wilson for World War I, FDR for World War II, and Bush for the Gulf War. War has a purpose to it. And to misunderstand that rationale, to rot it, or to convolute it in some way, is to risk a national trauma that matters just as much as public opinion does. War clarifies the landscape and identifies a new order in things. Make sure there is affirmation in the consensus you build for achieving new heights. The proverb I wish to leave you with for this evening's show is a Spanish proverb for further consideration and personal reflection. If love be timid, it is not true. Join me again next Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. In your blog, please leave me something to think about. As always, I want to thank the folks at BBS Radio, my promoter and producers, Deborah, Doug, and Don, for making this show possible and for all of the things you guys do to bring this show to our audience. Also, please remember to generously donate a contribution to our show. Your financial participation is a very valuable help for me. Thank you in advance. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling wishing for all of you a very pleasant evening. Good night.